This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weapa.org. Here's your host, Mike Causey.
Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and glad to have you with us today. My guest is Tom O'Rourke. He's a well-known estate and tax attorney in the Washington metro area. Many of his clients, I would assume maybe most, are either active duty federal workers or retirees, but Tom himself is a former Fed, worked with the Internal Revenue Service for many years, and before that, served in Vietnam. So he's been there, done that, got the T-shirt. Tom, welcome to the show.
So he's old, is what you're trying to say.
Exactly,
Mike.
Exactly.
You're trying to be polite.
Well, I went in this morning to get our free flu shot, and I said, I get a double dose. It's an age thing. And they said, oh, yeah, you're the one. So I'm the one. I must be the oldest person on the block that I get the double dose. But take what you can get. So any compliment you can get. Tom, you have a very – I hope people take a look at today's column, because as is often the case with the best Mike Causey column, Mike Causey didn't write it. You and I are talking about it, and I ask you for some bullet points, some discussion points, so we could plug today's show, and you've supplied them, and they're excellent. And I was thinking yesterday as I was looking over the stuff you had sent me in the health section of the Washington Post, on the front page of that particular section.
I saw that.
Did you? Yes. And I thought of us and thought of you and I thought of me. And a gentleman had written in, and he said, I'm ready to go. I didn't bring it with me today, but it's to the effect, I'm ready to go. And he said, I don't have a terminal illness. I'm not particularly old. There's nothing pending, nothing that I know of. But given the way of the world with COVID-19, the pandemic, and just the situation, he said he had been checking some boxes and dotting some I's and squaring some T's or whatever you do. And I thought, what a timely introduction to our show.
I thought exactly the same thing, uh-huh. Mike, when I read that article. Fortunately, many people are following the advice that the writer of that article gave. They are taking a look, and they do realize that, although I'm feeling well, I'm in good shape, and hopefully have a long time to go, I realize I need a plan for the future. And a lot of people have followed that advice.
Well, I saw something one time, and I can't remember whether it was a friend, and I've had two who were insurance agents. I mean, they went door to door and sold life insurance. Can't remember whether one of them told me this or I just read it somewhere, but they said that they called it a moment of truth or a pause or whatnot. And when the man, typically in those days, was about to sign a life insurance policy, there was always this hesitation, this moment, and they said they knew he was thinking of his mortality and, a variety of things, and it was almost as if signing this document was going to guarantee that it was going to happen. And, of course, their point was it's going to happen whether you sign the document or not. But I guess in times of a pandemic like this, when, we may be in different classes, but we're all in the same boat with this pandemic. And it has brought home our mortality to most of us, many of us. And, you can think about after you've gone without being particularly morbid, hopefully. And that's what we hope to get at today. You and I have discussed, Tom, and I'll stop rambling here. You and I have discussed before the fact that most Americans, if you ask them who they are, probably ask Jeff Bezos, and they'd say, upper middle class, or middle class. There's something Democrat with a small D that we like to think of ourselves as, as part of the group. But in fact, many, many people, particularly in the Washington area, and particularly people who work for the federal government, are actually better off than that in a number of ways. And they say they're not rich, and so they don't need an estate plan. And I know you must hear that on an almost daily basis. What do you tell people?
Well, I do. You're right. I do hear that on a regular basis, and my experience is just like yours. When I talk to people, they say, "I'm middle class. I'm not rich. I don't have all that much." And if they're a federal employee, they do have one asset that has a phenomenal value that doesn't show up on their net worth statement, and that's the value of their annuity. When they retire from the federal government, they have about the best guarantee they can get. They have a guarantee of a lifetime stream of income that is indexed for inflation that is going to be there as long as they are. And it's not immediately available. You obviously have to live to connect it. But when I've sat down and tried to figure out the value of an annuity, even a person who receives a relatively modest annuity, it can be worth over $1 million. And that's before you even look at things like life insurance or money in the TSP or any real estate. The other thing that I find for both federal employees and non-federal employees in the Washington, D.C. area, if they've owned a home for a long time, that home has just increased in value by a phenomenal amount. I deal with people day in and day out who bought a home back in the 60s or 70s that was worth anywhere from $40,000 to $100,000 that today is worth anywhere from $700,000 to $1.5 million. So just by being here and owning a home and going to work every day, people really do accumulate what to many is an unthinkable amount of wealth. They're certainly not in the Jeff Bezos category, but they're doing reasonably well.
Well, and as a friend of mine called in after the last time we did a show like this, and he said, he said everything Tom said was true, and he had a situation where he bought a house for in the low 80s, and it was now appraised at 800 something, just the same house.
That happens all the time, and it nothing special. He probably didn't. He may have done some fixing up a little bit, but no, that just happens. That's what inflation has done over the years.
Yeah, as they say, they're not making any more land, even in the Zuider Zee, I guess. But the other thing that he pointed out, which it's amusing, but it's also quite true, is he said one thing that we I think left out in that discussion was be sure you have the same husband or wife that you started out with 20 or 30 years ago, that people who have not divorced.
That is certainly true.
Yeah, people who have not divorced. That is certainly true. And one of them knew wherever he spoke. He was married four times. You know, when you're talking about the value of the annuity, I'm always struck by that because, you know, there are people who say annuities are the best deal in the world, you know, buying one from an insurance company. There is a guy on television who said I would die before I would sell you an annuity. He talks about how unsafe they are. But I have two friends, very prominent builders. They were talking one time. I've told the story before, but it just hit me as a wage guy, you know, a biweekly wage person all my life. But these two were talking, and one of them said, "What's your number?" And the one guy, he either said 3 or 4, and the other guy said, "Yeah, mine too." And I found out later, if they didn't say 4, they meant 4. But that was how much cash they needed or were going to need on hand to retire. That was their annuity. That was their guarantee. They didn't particularly want to invest it, certainly not all of it. They didn't want to buy an annuity because, you know, you may or may not get it. Now, the company may or may not go out of business. But the value of annuity, people who get something like the civil service retirement system or the federal employees retirement system, don't have a clue how much that's worth. And as you point out, too, with CSRS, it's fully indexed inflation. And with FERS, it's partially indexed, but it's still 100% better than most existing private retirement plans.
Oh, absolutely. And there are a variety of kind of an annuity, but the annuity federal employees talk about is the pension they earn from years of service. And that's guaranteed, although Uncle Sam has had some rough times and is deeply in debt, his guarantee is still more solid than the guarantee of anybody else, certainly any insurance company. So persons who retire on a federal annuity have really about the best type of guaranteed future income they can possibly get. Uncle Sam's not going to run out of money. If he does, he's going to print some more.
Yeah, always work for the group that prints the money.
Yeah.
And, well, I think a lot of the times, too, I think many federal workers use the term annuity. They resent pension because pension, to many of them, implies that this is a gift from the employer. And as they point out, they contribute to their pensions, which most private sector people, of those who still have retirement plans, did not. So that's an important factor. Meanwhile, another important factor, you take a short break here. Eric White wants us to break. So we'll do that here on federalnewsnetwork.com, 1500 AM, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tom O'Rourke. He is a tax and estate attorney and planner in the Washington metro area. With a lot of federal clients, both current and former feds, and knows the ropes, having himself been in the Internal Revenue Service for many years before going into private practice. Tom, we're looking today at, and I like today's headline, and I actually wrote it. But the headline says the art of leaving a legible financial footprint. Point being, we all leave one, but for some people, it's a smear in the ground. You leave more trouble than you're worth. And I know in your career, and most of us have at some time or another known a family that was really thrown into turmoil, not only by the death of a loved one, which is always a shock and traumatic, regardless of the age or the cause or whatnot, but the aftermath, the things that were left unsaid, or the sibling split ups and the fights between in-laws and the heirs of an individual. And the point of all of this estate planning, or one of the major points, is to avoid that sort of things. And you have here, you say, we discussed the fact that most federal workers are worse, a lot more on the hoof than they think they are, particularly if they've been married to the same spouse for many years. If they bought a home back in the day, they're probably better off than they think. You said one of these sub points you sent was, everybody knows what I want, so why do I need a will?
I hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I'll teach a seminar and somebody will come up to me and said, Tom, you know, I hear what you're saying, but how do I convince my dad or my mother to say that? Every time I bring it up, they always give me the same answer. Everybody knows what I want. I don't need a will. And the theory is that mom or dad has treated all their kids equally, and they know when they die, they want everything to go to those kids equally. And then when you sit down and you start talking to mom or dad, they really don't mean that at all. You ask them, well, okay, who's going to be in charge of doing this? And they say, well, the kids. And I say, well, you know, have the kids ever disagreed about anything?
Uh-huh.
And they say, well, yeah, you got a problem there. I said, so they haven't thought about many of the things. And a lot of times when you bring up this subject, your loved ones can get a little bit belligerent about it. They say, look, I really don't want to talk about it. What happens after I'm gone is none of your business. I'm going to do whatever I want. So it's something that I've seen most particularly with older clients. They just assume everything's going to work out. And unfortunately, more often than not, that doesn't happen. Things don't just work out. One of the more important things you do when you develop an estate plan is you put somebody in charge. You pick an executor, you pick a trustee, somebody who's going to oversee how assets are distributed. And a lot of times, if you don't do that, there's a big fight among the family over who's going to be the executor, who's going to be the personal representative or the trustee. That has been the subject of more estate contests that I've been involved in, rather than who gets the money. Somebody wants to be in charge.
Yeah.
So and a lot of times when you explore that with people, they realize that, look, it's a relatively simple process. Many people do have somewhat modest assets, but they need to put somebody in charge and they need to specify who gets what. If mom or dad takes the time to write a will, their children, number one, the law is going to require them to respect what's been done in the will, but in most cases they do it voluntarily. They may think mom or dad made a mistake and didn't recognize the contribution of one child versus another to the family dynamic, but they'll accept it and they won't contest it, and the estate can be wrapped up a little more easily and in a less contentious fashion.
Well, one of my favorite war stories happens to be true. When I was a kid, I lived with an uncle and an aunt for several years. Wonderful people. They were farmers, and you know, very, very rural, very long, long ago kind of place, very primitive in some ways. And my uncle was many things, including very well read, but he was not well educated in a formal sense. But when he would have a temper tantrum, which was not unusual, he would go write a new will, and most people did not know that. Occasionally, he'd let it be known to sort of punish or advise, but more often than not, he'd just do it. And I think he left it several times to several major religions of the world and different institutions. When he died, his wife and her daughter, their daughter, were sort of at odds over things. And one of the wills was found. Nobody ever knew if that was the current one, the one he intended. But one of the wills was found, and he had worded it such that he intended for his daughter to get the farm because she loved the land and wanted to continue farming it. He knew his wife would sell it immediately. It was a family thing. But the way he worded it, he left his daughter the land, but his wife, unintentionally, through some English common law language, he left her all of the buildings, you know, the house, the barns, the outbuildings, a couple of silos. And so the daughter wound up having to buy the buildings so she could farm and live on the land from her mother, and neither had intended that or expected it.
Yeah, well, that does happen. When you mentioned that, I remember an article I saw many, many years ago in Money Magazine called the $400,000 tip. It was about a gentleman who was like your uncle, who every time somebody irritated him, he would change his will. And at the time he died, the most recent will left $400,000 to a waitress in a cafe where he had dinner every night. And she was really nice to him, so he figured, I'm going to leave her everything. Of course, things like that oftentimes lead to court battles, and usually when you get involved in a court battle with an estate, everybody loses. Everybody, that is, except members of my profession, lawyers, because if you're going to contest a will, you're going to hire a lawyer, and lawyers don't accept those types of cases on a contingent fee basis.
You know,
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say we titled in the little synopsis I gave you, I talked about misconceptions people have in putting together an estate plan. And still, one of the very biggest misconceptions is, I got to put an estate plan in place because if I don't, the state's going to get everything I have. I'm going to be really slammed with taxes. And that really is a misconception now. In my experience, most people, most truly middle-income people, simply don't need to worry about taxes payable at the time of death. There have been very significant changes in the tax laws over the last 5 to 10 years, and now only 20 of the 50 states even have any taxes at all that are payable at the time of death. At the federal level, you only need to worry about estate taxes if the size of your estate is more than about $11.6 million. And in the D.C. area, Virginia has no death taxes at all, no inheritance tax, no estate tax. And in Maryland and D.C., they do have taxes, but the first $5 million in assets is exempt. So for most people, taxes aren't the reason why you do an estate plan. Obviously, if the size of your estate is more than that, then taxes can be a relevant consideration. But having assets of more than $5 million isn't a real common issue for most folks.
And it's not a really bad problem to have either.
No. Having a tax problem in many instances is not a bad problem. You only have a tax problem if you have money.
Mm-hmm.
And so having too much money is usually the tax laws that do apply can be, you can use them to structure your estate to minimize taxes. But for most folks, it's a completely unnecessary exercise. You simply figure out, this is what I have, this is how I want to distribute it, and this is who I want to put in charge of making sure things get done.
You know, we're talking about some people's obsession with taxes. I remember 20-plus years ago, a well-known financial planner told me, and he just wasn't talking about me per se, but in general, he said, do all of your financial planning before your age, I think he said 60, that was his cutoff. Others would say 55,
yeah.
You know, some would say earlier. But, and again, it wasn't personal, he was just saying it. And he said, particularly if you're a man, because he said so many men of a certain age, and as they get older, they're more likely to happen, become obsessed with taxes, as in not paying same. And they will start to go to extraordinary lengths with, you know, with wills, estates, or even residence to avoid paying taxes somehow or other. And I know the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, great outfit. They have a wonderful monthly magazine. And two of their most popular issues are issues on state taxes and the state treatment of taxes on things like Social Security. Some tax, some don't. Military retired pay, some tax, some don't. Federal civil service annuities and whatnot. And I knew of a case, I've mentioned it before, someone from the D.C. area, Virginia, moved to Washington State, right on the Columbia River, right across from the Oregon border. And the reason he did it, and the sole reason he did it, he knew nobody out there that wasn't an outdoor type, didn't care about the Pacific Northwest or know anything about it, was so that he could live in Washington State, which at that time had no state tax, and shop in Oregon, which had no sales tax. And Eric is giving us the sign again. We're going to take a short break here. I'll be right back on Federal News Network, 1500 AM. Welcome back. This is Mike Causey, and we're at the midway point in your turn. I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke, a Washington-based tax and estate attorney, and really, really good advice as always. And Tom knows the federal situation and federal workers, and was himself one for a long period of time. Just to finish up on our tax segment, that individual I mentioned who left Virginia, moved to Washington State, which had no state tax, and lived across the river from Oregon, which had no sales tax at that time. And I wish there was a more interesting story, but he still lives there. He's still happy. He does not think he made any wrong choices. He's, you know, he's adjusted to life there. But as far as he's concerned, that was a major victory.
Well, and your story is one, every time I teach a seminar on taxes, I talk a little bit about where you might want to relocate when you retire. And I always say, of course, one of the issues for some people is taxes. And I always tell your story.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are just aghast. They can't believe that somebody would move to a place where they have no friends, where they've never been,
yeah,
merely to save taxes. And I always use that story to,
yeah,
make the point that taxes are certainly important, but they should not be the determining factor in your life.
And again,
unfortunately,
this,
for some people, they are.
That's right. And this financial planner said that men are particularly susceptible, and men of a certain age. That is the older we get,
yeah,
but it becomes a magnificent obsession not to pay taxes. Now, here's an interesting subhead that you gave us for today's column. I should leave everything to my children in equal shares. And it's for someone like me with four children, who get along extremely well for the most part, but they are different. What's the rationale behind that?
Well, what you describe, Mike, is what most people commonly do. If you have children, typically you love them all. And if you have more than one child, there's a great likelihood there's considerable differences yeah. among those children. Some of the children may be very successful financially, others may be struggling. But the default seems to be that parents love their children equally and they're going to divide their assets up equally among their children. Of course, there can be significant differences among children that would dictate a different result. But the point I always make when I'm talking to clients is there's only one right way to do this, and that right way is whatever you want. And if you have a child that has special needs and maybe needs a little extra help, then go ahead and do that. And in most cases, family members understand that and respect your wishes. But the most common solution I've seen most people come up with is I'm going to divide my assets equally among my children.
You know, I have a friend who has a sister who is something like 19 or 20 or 21 years older than he is. And he's done pretty well in life. She, not so much. And he is in a situation now, and he doesn't talk about it often, but where this older sister, you know, older by a generation, will call him and ask him for $75 to pay the electric bill or $200 for this. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrible situation. I don't want to ask him a lot of questions about how they got that way, but I think she is married or involved with a guy who was probably not your best provider. And one of the things I would add to the situations you've mentioned, you know, you have 4, 5, 6 kids. They're not all created equal. Some do this, some do that. They all have their good points and their bad points. But one thing in this day and age, one of the wild cards that I think so many people face is the problem of drugs. You know, opioid crisis. And if you have an adult child with a drug problem, this is what problems are all about.
Well, and the important part of estate planning is to know that. And if you have a child who has a drug problem, you're aware of it. But if you're aware of the problem, you can come up with a solution to it. And most people who face that type of a problem, the way they solve it is they will leave a share of their estate to their child who has a drug problem, but they'll leave it to them in trust. And they will specifically tell the trustee, do not make any distributions if you suspect it's going to be used to support a drug habit or an alcohol problem. So if you can identify the problem, you can come up with a solution to that problem through your estate plan.
You know, question on that. I can't imagine being in a situation like that where I was the trustee, and I'm sure there's no pat answer. But is it better to have the trustee, someone like yourself, you know, a lawyer with experience in this, or is it better to have a family member?
Well, that is a question many people wrestle with.
Yeah.
The big advantage of having a family member is they know and understand the child for whom they're managing assets. That's the advantage. They're going to have the child's best interest at heart. The disadvantage is it can be very difficult. It can strain the relationship between the two children. And for many people, that tips the scale in favor of picking a disinterested third party or an institution. If I'm named as trustee for somebody who's not in my family, I'm going to do exactly what the trust agreement tells me to do. And if that hurts the feelings of the beneficiaries, so be it. My obligation is to carry out the terms of the trust. So in a lot of circumstances where you want the trustee to be able to say no, you would prefer that some disinterested third party occupy that position as trustee of a trust for a child with problems.
Yeah, and as you said, they know them well and intimately, and sometimes that's good, sometimes it's not so good. They may make judgments based on past performance that an outsider would not necessarily make, maybe in the best sense. And for my friend who's, you know, 20-plus-year-old sister, 20 years older than he, that creates some incredible problems. Tom, I know you got a question, and I forwarded it to you from someone who was talking about, particularly in these times of pandemic, when we're dealing with people but not actually seeing them. We're doing things remotely.
Yeah.
We're teaching.
Yeah, he had a question, which is coming up more and more frequently, but his question was as follows. In the age of COVID, what is being done to facilitate socially distanced, non-ink witnessing of designations of beneficiary for FERS, CSRS, TSP, FEGLI, and unemployment compensation? Unfortunately, I've got an answer, but it's not a good answer. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. FERS, CSRS, and FEGLI are all administered by OPM. And the first bit of advice I'd give to anybody is to take a look at OPM's website. I do know the issue that I deal with all the time in my law practice is many estate planning documents need to be witnessed by some disinterested third party, and quite frequently they need to be notarized. And I know the state of Maryland and many bar associations have come up with remote witnessing and notarization. And it's really quite complicated. And to be candid with you, most people in my firm who do what I do have given up on it. We, since the pandemic is maybe under a little more control, we do, at least in my firm, we open our office for clients to come in on a very limited basis. And when they come in, there are restrictions. We require them to fill out a form attesting they don't have the coronavirus or any symptoms. We require them to wear a mask. We socially distance. When we give them a pen, we sanitize those pens after they yeah. use them. And we go through that process because to do it otherwise, we just found to be unworkable. We tried to do it by using Zoom, and that was not terribly successful. So I honestly don't know what various federal agencies who administer benefit programs are requiring in the way of witnessing and notarization.
You know, it's funny, whenever anyone mentions notary publics, I guess there are a lot of younger people that don't even know what that is or what they do. But when I was about 8 years old, my mother was a secretary, and I remember when she became a notary public, I equated it with, you know, being made a federal judge, if not the Supreme
sure.
Court. But I thought we were in the big time. Nothing much
well,
changes.
Well, it is. And no, it's certainly a process which is still required for yeah. certain estate planning documents. You've got to have them witnessed by disinterested parties and notarized. And in days when you're trying to isolate, that's pretty hard to do.
A dumb question, but you said witnessed and then notarized. So the notary himself or herself is not necessarily the witness?
Not necessarily. In some states, the notary can be one of the witnesses. In other cases, they cannot be.
Okay, so you may need three people at the ceremony.
You need three people, yeah.
Okay.
And in my office, we've set up a procedure where we do it certain days, and we can have everybody there, but it is cumbersome.
Good. Okay, Eric's just given us a signal. He swears this will be the last break here on Federal News Network, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke. He's an estate planner and a tax attorney in the Washington area. And we're going. And Tom wrote the bulk of my column today about the art of leaving a legible financial footprint. And we've gone through some of the important ones. And a reminder, this show is archived on our homepage. So if you missed some of it or if you want to hear it again, pass it on to a friend or a relative. They can themselves listen anytime. Tom, the last couple of points on your 10-point checklist or 8-point checklist here are they're almost linked. It says, my spouse and I have been separated for many years, but haven't bothered to get a divorce. I'm not going to leave him or her anything. To which I would think, but is that true?
Well, it's certainly true. People do it all the time. But what they don't understand is every state has a spousal inheritance law.
Okay.
If you're married, your spouse is automatically entitled to a share of your estate, which can be a minimum of one-third to a maximum of one-half of your estate. So if you don't leave them anything, all they need to do is file a simple statement with the Register of Wills while your will is being probated, and they automatically get up to a half of any assets you may have. So now, a lot of people are unaware of that, and also a lot of people, if they've truly been separated for that long a period of time, they obviously don't have close contact with their former spouse, and they don't know that they died, and they so the will does get administered, and the former spouse doesn't get anything. But you need to be aware that your separated spouse can totally upset your estate plan if you are married. But as you said, the sort of the flip side of that, and this was brought home to me a number of years ago, where people have gotten a divorce, they then meet and establish a relationship with another person and move in together and live together for many years and establish a very close relationship. And it's the goal of both spouses, both parties to the relationship, to leave everything to their significant other. I had a couple a number of years ago that did that. They both had gone through terrible divorces. They didn't want to have to do it again. They lived together. They had a wonderful relationship. They had always intended to get married, but they just never quite got around to it. Well, the man died very suddenly of a heart attack. And the most significant asset he had was a house. Now, he had a job as a builder. And in his job, he either made a lot of money or he made no money.
Yeah.
And he was married to a federal employee who, the good thing about working for the federal government is you get a paycheck every 2 weeks.
Yep.
So the woman paid all the expenses of owning the home, including the mortgage. But his name only was on it. He died. He had no will. He left her nothing. And she had absolutely no right to the home. I've had other situations where people have lived together. Named their significant other as the beneficiary of their FERS or CSRS annuity, and they died, and then the significant other applied for a survivor annuity, and one of the questions you have to answer is, were you legally married at the time of the person's death? And they find out the person they spent most of their adult life with gets absolutely nothing because OPM has no authority to pay an annuity to somebody who to whom you're not married and have no blood relationship. So those are a little bit out of the ordinary situations, but they do arise often enough to create a problem, and there are certainly things that most people simply are not aware of, and they don't think about it.
When I was much, much younger, a different world, morality and the way people dealt with it and referred to it, but oftentimes we used to hear the term all the time, common law wife, common law husband. And we knew that it varied by state, but nobody quite understood what it was. Does that still exist? Does it have the force of law, or is it that depends?
Well, it still does exist in some states. And, and whether you're legally married is always a question of state law. And the states I deal with all the time are the local states. And I know in Maryland, there is no such thing as common law marriage. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you live with somebody for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you never go through the ceremony, you're not legally married. And I know I did have a case a number of years ago where it really was a tax issue. If you leave assets to your spouse, it qualifies for a marital deduction, and you're not subject to estate tax. And we had to try long and hard to convince the court that this couple had been married in Pennsylvania, because at least at the time, Pennsylvania was a state that recognized a common law marriage. And even though they didn't live in Pennsylvania at the time of death, you had to go back to Pennsylvania law because they did live there. And the question was this a valid marriage under Pennsylvania law? It's best not to rely on being able to make a good case. Usually what I tell people is if you're going to win a case at the Supreme Court, you've already lost. You've spent many years in litigation.
Good point.
You've spent a lot of money. It's better just to either, if you love somebody and you want them to be protected, you can either marry them and they'll have certain rights automatically, mm-hmm. or if you don't want to marry them, then you can prepare an estate plan that protects them.
Okay, sort of an obvious question here, but the difference between a will and a trust.
Well, they're both written documents that describe how you want your assets managed and distributed after you die. The will takes effect immediately. As soon as you sign it, it's there. The trust only becomes effective once it's funded, once you've transferred assets into it. Your will really only becomes operative after you die. So it's a plan for the management of your affairs after your death. The trust becomes effective as soon as it's funded, and assets are managed in accordance with the trust. Perhaps the main reason why most people decide they want to use a trust rather than a will is because if you have a trust and it's properly funded, it allows you to avoid probate. Probate is a process by which a court administers a person's will, and typically people want to avoid it because it takes time and it costs money.
Tom, we got just under 2 minutes here. Could you have 5 points that people should review, particularly in a time like this of a pandemic?
Well, yeah, that's something that I've seen a number of articles about this. In the time of coronavirus, people need to take a look. Do you have a will or trust? Is it still consistent with your wishes? If not, you need to change it. Secondly, you need to check your medical directives and financial powers of attorney. If you become incapacitated, who's going to step in and take care of you? This is a very important document. I've had several people contact me about their medical directives because of their concern about being hooked up indefinitely to a ventilator. A very important thing that's got nothing to do with seeing a lawyer is review your beneficiary designations. For most federal employees, the most important assets they have are their TSP, their FEGLI, if they have it, or other life insurance, and their annuity. Make sure your beneficiary designations are consistent with your wishes. Something people think about, or fail to think about, totally forget about, what happens to my pets when I die? Do you want them to be humanely euthanized? Do you want to give them to somebody else? Do you want them to be placed for adoption? If you have pets that are like family members, you want to deal with this issue in your will or your trust. And then finally...
Tom, excuse me, Eric is drawing his finger across his throat. I think that means we're through. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll have a good week. Stay safe. See you next Wednesday.
You've been listening to Your Turn with Mike Causey, brought to you by WEPA on Federal News Network. WEPA is the life insurance choice of over 46,000 federal workers and their families. Learn more at weepa.org.